Hello, everybody. Can you hear me, everybody? Look, good evening. I just wanted to say first up, and it's not in my notes here, I just wanted to say thank you very much for welcoming us, the three of us here. It's been jolly and lovely, so thank you. I appreciate being asked. So now I'll go to my speech, which I hope is not too long, and I hope you enjoy. I would like to thank first the Victorian chapter of the Naval Historical Society of Australia for asking me to speak here tonight. It is an honour to be asked to speak, as our stories always need to be told. So to the culprits responsible, I would like to thank Marty Grogan and Rex Williams, but it's really Marty's fault, so you can blame him.
Hooray for Marty.
What I'm about to tell you is the story of the book I am still writing. It's called The Skiff Party. So, as a starting point, let's start with an incident. On March 1, 1942, a battle. HMAS Perth and USS Houston sink in battle in the Sunda Strait off Western Java. 1,015 Houston men and 683 Perth men go into the sea that night. Many are lost, swept into the Indian Ocean, alone to die. Only 285 Houston men and 219 Perth men return to their homes after the war, all now POWs. It's chilling. But the story involves others. Approaching midnight on February 28th, as it was a leap year, two very young children, crouching low in a 16-foot skiff, watched the battle. No one knew this. Next day, ashore on one of the islands in the strait, Chief Petty Officer Ray Parkin was one of the 45 Perth survivors to meet and help the children. He later wrote about this in his book, Out of the Smoke. The one abiding comment from many of Ray's readers after this book was published was, "What happened to the children?" And as we are at dinner in a casual setting for Christmas jollies, I thought to tell you what happened to the children. And at the outset of my research, I had absolutely no idea of the dimension, but now I do. It was quite a lot of threats. As mentioned, the source of the story came from Ray Parkin, helmsman of HMAS Perth, from the horror days of the Mediterranean to her final battle in the Sunda Strait. I wrote Ray's bio, as you know, and one day when we were chatting in the kitchen, he mentioned the children. Ray had written a wartime trilogy in the 60s. Some of you may know it, probably all of you do, some may not. The books are Out of the Smoke, Into the Smother, and The Sword and the Blossom. They are, without doubt, the most balanced and well-written, honest and personal books that you will ever read about a 12-year man who goes to war, whose ship sinks in battle, whose survival and unsuccessful attempt to get home and then years as a POW are singular in their clarity. And as he said to me often enough, most of my readers turned out to be the wives and mothers of the POWs. He had been able to tell them what it was like up there. He was very proud of that, and he wasn't a proud man. In fact, he didn't like the word. As Ray wrote, it had taken him 12 hours to get through the incredible currents and the strong rips in the Sunda Strait before he crawled ashore on the sands of Sangian Island. He was near dead. He slept. He made a rough covering out of a ship's sail that had floated in for his naked, oil-covered body, and then he began to walk along the beach. What's next, he wondered. He walked around the headland and then into the next bay, where a 16-foot sailing skiff was moored on the rock platform off the beach. In the skiff were three Australian sailors, a Malay woman that the men had nicknamed the Mrs. I have called her Anne in my book to give her a better name, and two small English children, Mary and Robin Bull. Mary is 12 and Robin is 7. It floored Ray that here, in the middle of a war, on a deserted tropical island, he runs into children, alone, children escaping from the Japanese. Ray had two children of similar age back home, and they were safe. He wondered at the why and the how of this. What could possibly happen next to the world if this is where children end up in a war? The children remained an enigma for Ray. Years later, he wrote only this small part of their story, as he didn't know what became of them. But it was enough to get me really interested. The skiff party is about the Bull family. It's a true story, and Bull is their real name. There are small parts in the manuscript where I have filled in the dots, using my knowledge of the time and the people to make it more readable. I haven't Kate Grenvilled it, as I say it, but I have added 5%, maybe even 10% to help the story along. The rest is about real people, real events, and real outcomes. So I'll try and put you there. The Bulls are an English family living in Singapore, just as it is about to fall. The Bulls are an English family living in Singapore, just as it is about to fall to the Japanese. And the father is a district court judge, Harold Robert Bull. Annabelle is his wife. The story is about two of their three children, Mary and Robin, as I've mentioned before. Mixed throughout is the bravery and the kindness of strangers, the horrors of war and internment, and the resilience of these two small children cast into the sea, alone. It's February 1942 and the Japanese are racing down the Malay Peninsula. Judge Bull knows he has left it far too late to evacuate his children and his family. Panicking, he manages to get them passage aboard the SS Viner Brook. He remains behind. His duty is to king and country. Mrs. Annabelle Bull, some 10 years younger than the judge, now has sole charge of the three children. Now, she's never done this before. Mary, a rather grown-up 12-year-old, Robin, a gentle 7, and the youngest, 4-year-old Hazel. And remember, these are children of the British Empire. They're spoiled children living a wealthy, luxurious life in a raffles Singapore. At sea, only a day out of Singapore, which is the 14th of February, on a hot and glassy, clear, green, stinking hot day, the Viner Brook is dive-bombed by a flight of Japanese planes. And about 2:30 in the afternoon, she sinks at the northern tip of Banker Island, just as she was about to enter the Banker Strait, which was then a real gun alley. The Japanese had control of the seas and the skies, so few ships got through. In fact, only four did. Singapore was to fall the following day. History says over 300 evacuees were aboard. They were mostly women, children, and the elderly. 100 plus survived the sinking. The Viner Brook is a famous name in our history, in our World War II history. Famous because she also carried 65 Australian Army nursing sisters. One of them was the indomitable nursing sister Vivian Bullwinkle, whom I wish I had met. The famous Bullwinkle, or Bully as she is known. Of the 65 nursing sisters, 12 drowned, 21 were murdered by the Japanese on Raji Beach on Banker Island a day after the ship sank, and 8 were to die later in camps. 25 survived, including Vivian. Reading some of their stories of survival puts one's own life into perspective. Of the books I have read, written by some of these nurses, thankfully they mention Mrs. Bull and her children, because there's been an awful lot of research for this. Surprising how it all came together. Annabelle Bull and her three children survive the Viner Brook sinking, but they were separated aboard during the air raid. While struggling in the water, Mrs. Bull holds tight to her youngest. She holds tight to Hazel, the 4-year-old, but she has no idea where Mary and Robin are or if they've even survived. I believe Annabelle was faced with the Sophie's choice on that afternoon, which one to save. She saves the youngest. She believes her other two have drowned. Vivian Bullwinkle and Annabelle Bull and little Hazel were later interned in Sumatra's Palembang civilian internees camp. If you remember the film Paradise Road, well, that incorporates Vivian and Annabelle's camp and story. I feel sure you all know Vivian's remarkable story, but just in case, Vivian was the only survivor of the group of 22 Australian nursing sisters who were murdered by Japanese troops on Raji Beach. It happened the day after the sinking of the Viner Brook. This massacre of Australian servicewomen is regarded as one of the worst war atrocities directed at Australians in World War II history. As you can see, we have gathered together threads here of a story. We have Annabelle Bull and Hazel and Palembang with Vivian, plus the other surviving Australian Army nursing sisters together with other women and children from the various evacuee ships sunk in and around the Banker. And we have Annabelle, who is now desolate that she's lost her two children. So now to the children. and the core of the story. Mary and Robin survive the sinking, but they lose sight of their mother and sister. They lose sight of everybody. They are swept away into an empty sea. And remember, it's late in the afternoon. They're alone in the water and night is coming. And they are fearful. They are going to die. But the children remain afloat until Anne, the missus, a Malay woman, literally drags them onto her piece of wreckage as she passes them in the current that rushes down the Banker Strait. Anne had herself been on the Vina Brook. Now, in a few sentences, I have given you the simple premise of they are surviving, but can you even begin to consider how terrified those two little children were at night until Anne got to them? I can't. They were alone. In fact, it's been a very difficult chapter for me to write because they were likely to die. Anne and the two children clinged for dear life to their piece of wreckage, desperate until, extraordinarily, the 16-foot sailing skiff, manned by three RAN sailors, sails past, comes about and hauls them aboard during the night. The sailors are also fleeing from Singapore. Ray gave a few indicators of who they were, but not enough to identify them, yet he liked them. They were sailors. He trusted them. HMAS Vendetta gets a mention, as did an unnamed merchantman. They could have been deserters, and I've put a question mark there, they could have been. They could also have been doing what hundreds and hundreds of others were doing, getting the hell out of Singapore any way they could. Abandoned ship, every man for themselves. Who knows? I don't know. Even the Sultan of Johor's luxury yacht was sailed out of Singapore. It was literally an armada of every ship, every boat and barge and sailing ship and motorised launch under the sun, all trying to make for somewhere out of Singapore. Our skiff was making for Australia. The RAN sailors are a rough and ready lot, but they do take to the care of their new charges as best as they can. Hugging the coast and lying low during the day, only sailing at night, sees the skiff leaving the southern coastline of Sumatra and moving into the Java Sea at the top of the Sunda on the night of February 28, 1942. And so, this is when those in the skiff were unlucky enough to be in the strait when the battle between Perth and Houston and an enormous number of Japanese cruisers and destroyers exploded around them. To me, and this is really to me, the Battle of the Sunda Strait is one of the most plucky battles in our naval history. And again, just imagine two little children being there, watching this and watching and being around the aftermath. I do contend that this battle is the Navy's Passchendaele, or that of the charge at the neck at Gallipoli. Perhaps I'm speaking to the converted here, but do ask your neighbours if they know anything about the Battle of Sunda Strait, and I bet they don't, or very little. And Australians should know of it. I haven't researched this next comment to the nth degree, but I'm going to say it anyway. I can't recollect of any one other hour and 20 minutes in any war, in any service, where our men fought alongside American forces and so many men from both countries lost their lives together. Two ships fought to the death, two ships were lost, two ships' companies were lost, and two captains were lost. Next day finds the skiff moored on the small Sangian Island that I have mentioned. And it's here where my first-hand account of the meeting with Ray and the Bull children begins, because he told me about them. Ray meets and befriends the children on the island, and he and some of the other Perth men help the skiff sailors provision to leave the next day, as the tide is making, because I love saying that line. Ray said one of the other Perth members, a Perth survivors, also made a special fuss of the children. Ray named him Ben in Out of the Smoke. In life, he was leading seaman Harold Ashton Chaffee, a Tasmanian and a 12-year RAN man, a sailor like Ray. Now, Ben has always been an intriguing draw card for me. In fact, his wee bit of the puzzle is why I did this book, I think. To understand how, we need to stay for a moment longer with the Perth survivors on the island. Two lifeboats left Sangian Island after the skiff party left. One was Ray Parkins, which they named the Anzac, and the other one was Ben's, named by Ray as Ginger's lot. Ray didn't like them very much at all, so he dismissed them, you know, the smoking, didn't like them. Except he liked Ben. Ray's Anzac tried for Java in Australia and failed, while Ben's, together with 14 other Perth lads, sailed for Sumatra. They were making for India, they were sailing northwest. They too failed, sadly, and were captured. In history, their attempt for freedom is called the Sumatran Boat Party. Ben and his lot ended up in a POW camp in Palembang in Sumatra. They all survived. Now, why am I telling you about Ben? Because it was Ben who, months later, as a POW in Palembang men's camp, would hear word through the grapevine of an Englishwoman who, after months of grieving, was giving up and dying of a broken heart as she had lost her two children aboard a ship out of Singapore. Ben's men's camp was very near Annabelle Bull's women's camp, and in putting two and two together and hoping like the very devil that he was right, he wrote a concise and poignant message which was smuggled through to Annabelle, which read, literally read this, he literally wrote this, "I have seen your children, I have been with them, they are alive." Annabelle pulled through. Ben's clever and audacious action saved a woman, and most certainly her small child. And I don't know if Ben, you know, ever knew what came after. And to add to this, in my research, I believe that it was Nurse Mavis Hannah, the 2nd Ford CCS, who carried the note from Ben to Annabelle between the camps. And as you can imagine, that would have been done at great danger to herself. As a storyteller, I know Ben is one of the reasons I'm writing any of this, and I just love the story about the note. I also have a sneaking suspicion Ray knew I would write about the children. It feels now that he threw me a line, and like a good little brown trout, I went in for the lure. So, back to Mary and Robin. After the skiff party sets off from Sankeyan Island for the next stage of their attempt for Australia, everything goes wrong. When they reach the western shore of Java, the local Bantan villagers slaughter the RAN sailors, leaving Anne begging the natives not to kill her children. The three are now destitute. With nothing and no one to help, they roam the mountainous inland of Java trying to reach the Dutch forces, which Anne hopes still hold some of Java. She was wrong, of course. Mary and Robin and Anne get lucky and are taken in by a series of people who pass them on towards the large city of Serang. Here, they are taken into a convent and some safety. This is where I've added that 5% bit and piece, but from my knowledge of the time, I think I have been able to fill in a few of the dots. By now, the Japanese have Java, and the hard truth is that every Westerner is a prisoner. But the convent that they are now in offers some sanctuary, even though the Japanese know that there are people in there and they'll eventually get them. But they've got some time. They've got some time. Weeks pass, and from a makeshift internment camp in Serang Jail, the story of the English children reaches two senior YWCA women, Leela Bridgman, a New Zealander, and Eileen Higgs, a woman from Western Australia. They have been interned in the jail with some of the Perth survivors. The Perth men appear again and again through this story. Leela and Eileen had made the same fateful journey out of Singapore with the same outcome. They were aboard the SS GNB, which was sunk the same day as the Vina Brook. Leela and Eileen then reached Java, and they too were captured. But now in Serang, with the help of the local Dutch authorities and the approval of the Japanese, the women take Anne and Mary and Robin into their care, and the small group of five move through to Batavia, to a YWCA safe house. It's an odd part of the story here because the women are led out of the jail and the YWCA provides a car for them to go to Batavia. It's really quite odd. And the perception of the civilian internment is quite mixed from the Japanese point of view. It's interesting. In Batavia, eventually all female Britishers are interned in a civilian internees camp named Tijen. It's a majority Dutch camp, but there are Australian, American and British women and children in there as well. Anne, being a Malay, cannot go with the children. In truth, there are ructions between Leela, Eileen and Anne. Tijin camp was the Japanese idea of corralling all allied women and children in one place and then hoping that they would die. By hiving off two down at the mouth suburbs from the rest of the city and putting up a high wire and bamboo fence, it became a walled-off compound. And with few sailors to run it, and eventually 10,000 women and children living in squalid and hugely overcrowded areas, they all died. No, I can't say that. They died in large numbers. Little food, then communal food. The water was turned off, no medicine, no sewage, and every inch of every house was used to exist, with not much of anything except death. In the last year, the death rate was enormous. The final Japanese camp commander was a sadist. Leela wrote in her diary, and I quote, "That man is at war with himself." I always thought that was an exceptional comment. She didn't ever say anything bad about anybody, but that was about as bad as it got. And he was responsible for the huge spike in the death rate, and for no reason at all. Ironically, he had come from bicycle camp in Batavia, where many of the Perth survivors were still POWs. For his war crimes, the Dutch hanged the Japanese officer very quickly after the surrender. It was almost indecent how quickly justice came. Years of sickness, death, starvation and oppression had been the children's lot. Yet it was Leela and Eileen, both strangers, who provided protection and family to keep the children safe through all this horror until the end of the war. Protection also came from Anne, whose story, as she is real, is bravery itself. Her story is also very sad, but you'll have to read about Anne in the book. These three were good women, Anne, Leela and Eileen. Luckily, I have seen newsreel footage of the day Leela Bridgman left Tijin. Leela was the General Secretary of the YWCA in Singapore in 1941, and the Y came to find her in 1945. They got her out very quickly. It was wonderful for me to see what she and Eileen actually looked like on film. It was a special find. What is so very impressive to me about the story of the Bull family is the end. And once more, thanks to the art of diary writing and letter writing, I know what happened. After the British reoccupation of Singapore and just prior to the signing of surrender, Lady Edwina Mountbatten, I will call her Lady Edwina Mountbatten and not Lady Louis Mountbatten, dressed in the uniform of St John's Ambulance, flies into that city to assist her husband. Lady Mountbatten worked all points north, south, east and west in her job to get the prisoners of war and the civilian internees home quickly. I just fell in love with this woman. She is remarkable. Her job was to cut through the red tape, and she did. She was also heavily involved with Red Cross and was known to carry Red Cross lists of missing persons with her wherever she went. I know many ex-POWs, and I know a lot of them, who loved her for what she did, and she actually went to the POW camps. The men still sing her praises. Instead of telling you what happened next, I will let Leela, YWCA's Leela Bridgman, speak for herself. Leela wrote the following document while living in Toronto, in Ontario, after the war, and I'm sure you will agree, it is such a voice of the time. So this is Leela. At last, the end of the war came, and suddenly for me, the opportunity to be flown back to New Zealand. Eileen had agreed to care for the children in such an eventuality. We thought they should not be taken so far from the area where they were most likely to hear of their parents. After sad farewells to the family of our little camp family, I was flown across to Singapore, the first stage of my homeward journey. Imagine my joy when within a few hours of arrival, I learned from fellow patients in an Australian hospital where I was billeted that the children's mother and little sister, having been interned in Sumatra, were safely back in another hospital in Singapore. Their father was also free again and staying at Raffles Hotel, the official centre where British POWs for all the adjoining countries were gathered and so marvellously cared for by the YWCA War Services Women. It's fantastic. And the stalwart Jean Begg of New Zealand, who was a friend of Leela's. It was she who found me in the hospital and in her inimitable way cut all the red tape of hospital routine and took me to Raffles. Judge Ball spent, as an aside, he spent his entire wartime in Sime Road Jail in Singapore. He was a POW. Now back to Leela. I had been at Raffles less than an hour when I found the children's father and had the wonderful news for him that they were alive and well. Clutching unopened my first letter from home for over 3 years, I told him everything I could to fill in the gap of the years of separation. Of course, the immediate concern was to get the children over from Java, and only military personnel were going across, and despite various efforts for several days, nothing happened. At this time, Lady Louis Mountbatten, in Singapore with her husband, visited me and was interested to hear of our internment experience, and especially the story of Mary and Robin. 2 days later, a great Thanksgiving service was held in St. Andrew's Cathedral. As we sat in the packed cathedral waiting for that unforgivable service to begin, Lady Louis walked up the aisle to take her place in the front pew. Suddenly Jean Begg said to me, "Lady Louis is flying to Java tomorrow on the Red Cross business. I'll ask her to bring the children back." A brief note, hastily scribbled on a piece of paper, was handed to her chauffeur after the service. We heard nothing further until the following Tuesday, when quite unannounced, Robin and Mary arrived with Lady Louis. How lovely to see them again and so soon. Their father had gone to pay a morning visit to their mother in hospital, so I took them to have morning tea. We sat at a table at Raffles on the far side of the big hotel ballroom, my eyes never long away from the entrance. Suddenly the father was there. Almost too stirred to speak, I managed to say, "Mary, look." Sorry. Words breaks me up. Ridiculous. "Mary, look." Following my gaze, she saw him. Give me a minute. Can't do it. I was hoping I wouldn't. Following my gaze, she saw him. In a moment, she sprang across the room, Robin following after. She leapt upon her father, arms around his neck, legs clutching his body. A little later, they came to me. The father, hardly conscious of his action, bent his face and I kissed his cheek. As soon as transport was available, we were off to the hospital, to the children's mother, and there again was the indescribable joy of reunion. How wonderful this miracle of a whole family reunited, and what a deep satisfaction to know that Robin and Mary, for so long an important part of our life during the years of internment, were safely back to their heart's home. I love that term, their heart's home. Standing aside, I watched them for a minute and then slipped away. Always breaks me up, as you saw, sorry. What I have just told you tonight is a story that wasn't a story until I put it together. Threads came from everywhere, and I was lucky, that's for sure. This story of the Bulls fascinates me very much, as its truth rings large bells of humanity in all the disparate accounts that I've found. From Ray speaking to me in his kitchen, which led to the discovery of how two children endured the war and were reunited with their parents and little sister, deserves a well-told outing. That Leela and Eileen, the HMAS Perth men, the Australian Army Nursing Sisters, the YWCA, Lady Edwina Mountbatten, an unknown Malay woman, and three Australian sailors, now sadly lost to history, all played such a part in an important story in the Bulls family's survival and reunion, needs to be remembered. It is amazing it all fitted together, and I think military-minded historians tend not to write books about civilians in wartime, and perhaps they should. So as I said in the beginning of this speech, it is an honour to do what I do, and at times it is a wonder, and I think this story is a bit of a wonder. Thank you, and thank you for listening. Who can? I won't mind at all. And if you don't have any, I don't mind either.
Actually, I'd like to know about the salvage efforts on the ships.
Okay. Well, I was hoping, someone would ask me that. I've had a lot of, I've had a lot to do with trying to help save Perth. I can say I've put months of my life to it because it irritates the hell out of me. And I have written and spoken to ministers face to face and written a lot of letters and caused a lot of arguments with a lot of people I shouldn't argue with. But it hasn't done much good. And only 3 weeks ago, the Dutch sent a group of Australian and Dutch divers to dive on the ships above Surabaya, which of course was the Battle of the Java Sea. And I have been told that of the 13 shipwrecks they surveyed, 11 are completely gone. It is, the quote site is unbelievably thorough. The Java is gone. The De Ruyter, which had a 170-metre trench where it had once laid, is absolutely gone. The Exeter, in which human remains were seen by this group. The Encounter, a British destroyer, and another British destroyer are all gone. They heard tell of fishermen coming up to the salvagers and asking them what they were doing, and they were told to go at gunpoint. The salvagers are on big barges, so I can't imagine how someone didn't know they were there. Basically, there's nothing left. The Dutch group tried to get over to Perth, but they were about 2.5 more hours away, and then they had to get back. But they were told that the Perth has been got at again. Houston is a bit luckier. She's closer inshore. But it's awful. The Dutch government brought it up, went back, oh, furious. They went back and brought it up in Parliament. And it's hardly made any news here. They're very angry. The Electra is still there, because it's quite large, but her props have been taken. The cost to the environment is enormous. The Exeter, for example, was fully bunkered, and that would have just gone into the ecosystem. The loss of the rookeries for the fish is catastrophic. The Electra, as my friend says, was so alive with fish, yet the others are just gaunt, vacant spots on the seashore. The fear is that the beautiful, apparently it's really very pristine and beautiful, is the Dutch K-16 submarine, which has got 30 men still on board. They haven't got to that yet. But there's not too much else to take. It seems as if they'll just take everything. They will, and it's, the Indonesians aren't making it easy, and let's say it for what it is, it's Chinese salvagers and the Cambodians are doing it for them. And no one will officially say that, and every single minister for every single department says it's someone else's job. And it's finally got down to the Australian National Maritime Museum, who aren't handling it, not very well. And it's not being done, and Perth won't be saved. And two much cleverer historians than me about Perth, who know the ship intricately, I figure there's about 30 or 40 men who never got out. They're still there. They're still there. And Perth has been raped now 2-3 times. We'll lose her. Absolutely lose her. And it is not fair, and we should do something about it. We haven't ratified the convention, and our government is not protecting our ships. So, there's my answer. It makes me very angry.
Thank you very much. I know there's other questions, surely, but what a fantastic tale you've weaved.
I hope so. I'm sorry I broke down, but I tried so hard not to. That letter just touches my heart. I'm literally not going to change it in the book. That particular document is so beautifully written of its time. I could not tell that better. And so I'm just going to leave it as is and hope that people break down like I did. The other document I found was a 2-page letter from the judge, which I could have jumped up and kissed the sky when I found it, and it came out of the British War Museum, and he wrote this 2-page handwritten letter from South Africa, because they got together and they went to South Africa. It was better than going back to England, you know, at that time. They went to South Africa and he just wrote to a family friend, which confirmed enough for me to discover that it was the YWCA women that protected these two children. I mean, it is to me the kindness of strangers, the beauty and the care and the love that those two women, who didn't have children, and they looked after them in that dreadful camp. I mean, I'm hoping that you like it, and I'm hoping that people buy it, but I think it's an important story to tell. So thank you all.
I think another round of applause.